This is HEC Media.
Welcome to Talking with Authors, a program dedicated to speaking with some of the best-selling authors around, covering many different genres. I'm your podcast host, Rod Milam, for HEC Media. With the help of independent bookstore Left Bank Books and the St. Louis County Library, we are able to sit down with amazing writers and thought leaders to discuss their work, their inspiration, and what makes them special. By the way, you can also watch versions of most of these interviews by going to hecmedia.org. Today, our author is journalist and New York Times bestselling writer Charles Fishman. We spoke with him as part of a book tour for his latest work, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon, in July of 2019, 50 years to the month after this historic transmission was first heard.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Charles went from being a little kid in 1969 listening to that call from Neil Armstrong on the moon to capsule communicator Charlie Duke on Earth to being a journalist with multiple beats, including being a space reporter with the Washington Post. Now, the stories of the 21 individuals that flew to the moon during NASA's Apollo program have been widely written about by the astronauts themselves and others. But in One Giant Leap, Charles Fishman wanted to focus on something else.
The story I was interested in was the story of the people who got the astronauts to the moon, because that's not a well-told story. Ordinary Americans rose to the occasion in this remarkable way, and they're the ones who got us to the moon, right? The astronauts flew the spaceships, but they didn't build the spaceships. They didn't design the spaceships. They didn't imagine the spaceships. The astronauts would be the first to tell you that that work was more important even than their own work. 410,000 people worked on 11 Apollo missions. It's the largest undertaking by human beings ever in history that was not a war.
We'll hear about some of the 400,000 plus tales of the, quote, bunch of guys and women that were, quote, about to turn blue down there, as well as thoughts on the state of space travel today from journalist and writer Charles Fishman on this episode of Talking with Authors from HEC Media and HEC Books. Here's our host and interviewer this time, Angie Weidinger.
Charles Fishman, welcome to St. Louis.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be in St. Louis.
I think you wrote in your book that you were 8 when the Apollo mission.
I was 8 at Apollo 11, and I was building, you know, Saturn V models and lunar module models. I have in those days, once the mission happened, you couldn't replay it because there was no replay. There was no recording. But you could mail away a coupon from the newspaper for all these missions and buy a record album of the mission. And they put the coupons in the newspaper before the mission. And I actually have a record album of, I think it's the Gemini 8 and Gemini 9 mission. And I used to sit, it's the first moonwalk, the Gemini mission in which, so it's not Gemini 8 and Gemini 9, the first moonwalk, Ed White, and the Gemini mission after that, one on one side, one on the other side. And I remember I would have been 6 or 7 sitting on the floor in my bedroom playing that album over and over again. And I still have it. And I took it off the shelf when I started working on the book and put it on the turntable. And it is still hypnotic. You can, of course, listen to all that stuff on the internet now. It's all been uploaded. But absolutely, I was really captured by by the sort of little kid romance of space, you know, that sound. Flying to the moon sounds cool when you're 8 years old. It sounds cool when you're 58 as well.
So the fire was lit then, but you said in 1986 is when you really said, oh boy, that was when you really got.
Well, I was a space reporter for the Washington Post. I covered the Challenger disaster, mm-hmm. Which was, a daunting story to cover. That's the accident in which the teacher in space, mm-hmm. Krista McAuliffe, and 6 astronauts were killed. So that was not a fun story in any way, but fascinating, challenging, important. The Post, we actually had five people covering it full time for 6 months. So one of those events that that got a lot of attention for a long time.
Sure.
And so that sort of connected me to the world of NASA. The world of NASA in the 1980s was not the Apollo NASA. It was a different kind of organization then. But I was in Houston for about 6 weeks of that 6 months, and the reporters worked in a workspace, a temporary workspace that they set up for us, right next to a real lunar module. And at one point, we asked the press people at the Johnson Space Center if they would let us look inside. And we got to climb up the ladder of the lunar module and step into the cabin. And that, I really think that was the moment when I was sort of reconnected with the Apollo missions. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've written three previous books, but this is the book I've always wanted to write. And
really?
So with the anniversary coming, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I thought, well, that's, you know, there's the right occasion to try and tackle the story.
The time is now.
Right.
And in your book, I mean, you interviewed many, many astronauts for this book.
I certainly interviewed hundreds of people who worked on Apollo. I was less worried about astronauts. The 12 men who have walked on the moon have written 15 books. Among them, just those 12 guys have 15 books. So it would take you a month just to read the books, just that the guys who've walked on the moon have written, and they have sort of told their story. For me, the story I was interested in was the story of the people who got the astronauts to the moon. We always tell the moon story from the perspective of the astronauts, and that's totally understandable. And there's lots of astronauts in my book. But I wanted to tell the story of going to the moon from the perspective of the people back on Earth who had to do the work, because that's not a well-told story.
And that's what's fun, because it's people that we all can kind of relate to, right?
Exactly. Ordinary Americans sort of rose to the occasion in this remarkable way, and they're the ones who got us to the moon, right? The astronauts flew the spaceships, but they didn't build the spaceships. They didn't design the spaceships. They didn't imagine the spaceships and all the things that went along with it. And so that too is a great story. And the astronauts would be the first to tell you that, you know, that work was more important even than their own work.
We're talking a lot of people, 410,000 people over the course of the mission?
It's kind of extraordinary. 410,000 people worked on 11 Apollo missions, 410,000 people working on 11 flights, and that was more people in the late 1960s than were fighting in Vietnam in 3 years of the war. So really, it's the largest undertaking by human beings ever in history that was not a war. I mean, it was 10 times the size of the Panama Canal, 3 times the size of the Manhattan Project, really an unbelievable sort of Herculean undertaking. And so there's great stories, you know. There's great stories all through there.
Right. 2.8 billion hours of work.
That was a fun afternoon doing the math to add up the total number of hours of work. What's more interesting in some ways is you take the total amount of work that was done and divide it by the total number of spaceflight hours. There were 2,500 hours of Apollo missions, about 100 days. Even that number is a little surprising. We don't think of the moon missions lasting 100 days because we have these little clips of the astronauts on the moon that last 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. But there were 11 missions, and some of them were quite long. The moon landing missions lasted 8 or 9 or 10 days, depending on how long they were on the moon. For every hour of space flight, for every hour of flying to the moon, walking around, driving around, 1 million hours of work was done back on Earth. And a typical American works 100,000 hours in their entire career. So an hour of Apollo space flight required the equivalent of the entire work lives of 10 people. That's sort of mind-boggling. Imagine being allowed to do something for 1 hour that 10 people had worked their entire careers to get you ready to do. And then the next hour, 10 more people had worked their entire career. That sort of that level of intensity is almost unimaginable. And so that's what going to the moon required. It was really, really hard.
Intensity, that's a good word, because I know when you in your book you talk a lot about how there was the standard of perfection. Things had to be figured out because one little slip could mean disaster.
Right. Space is an all new operating environment, and I don't really think, obviously NASA and the astronauts and the companies that work in space today appreciate this, and we learned it in the 1960s, but it's a very different environment. I tell the story in the book of a single dash, a single line that was omitted from a piece of software, and just that one line that was the length of an ordinary dash not being in the computer program caused an entire rocket to have to be destroyed and a robotic space probe. If a bolt wasn't in the right place on a B-52 bomber, to be honest, if 20 bolts weren't in the right place or weren't screwed in exactly correctly, the plane wasn't going to fall out of the air. But space is a much more unforgiving environment, and computers are much more unforgiving. There's a difference between a one and a zero in a computer program, and it often is all the difference in the world. And so the work, that is what is so impressive. A lot of work back on Earth was done by hand. Mm-hmm. The spacesuits were sewed by hand. The parachutes were folded by hand. The wheels of the lunar rover were made of piano wire. And the piano wire was also woven by hand. And if any of that work wasn't done perfectly, then the spacesuit might not perform the way it needed to on the moon. And so, yes, it was very exacting. And there was a culture inside NASA in that era. And I think people knew about this. The astronauts would go visit people in factories. They would do factory visits. And it sort of looked kind of like PR-y, but it really wasn't. When you go back and talk to some of those people who are still alive and also just read accounts of them talking about it from that era, what that did was remind some of that, you know, every spacesuit was 21 layers. So you are nesting 21 layers of fabric, hand sewn, one inside the other, each having to be perfect. Those spacesuits were custom tailored to each astronaut. That's actually not exciting work. That's pretty tedious work, right?
Sure.
It has to be perfect.
And the stress that has
to,
you know,
right.
That
it has to be
perfect,
but it also is not thrilling moment to moment.
Right.
And so the visits of the astronauts really connected the work that was being done every day with real people and also with the mission itself. They obviously didn't want to put anybody in harm's way. The people building airplanes today don't want to put anybody in harm's way either. But there was this other part, which was it wasn't just the astronauts, it was the reputation of the whole country relying on the quality and the diligence of that work. And having the astronauts go visit all of these factories was a way of saying thank you, was a way of reminding people that the people who are going to use this stuff actually knew that there were people out there making it, but it was also a way of sort of keeping up morale and reminding the folks doing the work where this stuff was going. You weren't just working on a little piece of this. This was part of a huge, important project.
I love how you talk about LOL, the not laugh out loud, the little old ladies.
So the most amazing example of this sort of high-tech equipment that was made by hand is, in fact, the computer. Each of the spacecraft had a computer on board, the command module and the lunar module, and the computers were identical, but they were programmed differently because the command module flew to the moon and back, and the lunar module flew from orbit in the moon down to the moon and back. So they needed to be programmed differently. Those computers were the smallest, fastest, most advanced computers that had ever been created at that moment. but we didn't actually have the technology to manufacture the circuitry. And so the wiring of the computers, the programming, was woven by hand, as you say, by women who got the nickname Little Old Ladies, the LOL ladies, in a factory in Waltham, Massachusetts. They weren't old. Most of them were clearly in their 30s or 40s if you look at the pictures and watch the videos. And they were literally former textile workers. Every single one and zero in the spacecraft computer was woven by a woman with a needle attached to wire, getting the wire in the right place. And you were talking about how everything had to be perfect. If a single wire of that program was done incorrectly, was misrouted, the computer would not work right. That wasn't the memory for the computer. It was the actual programs being woven by hand by women sitting at looms in a factory in Waltham, Massachusetts. And so that's sort of mind-boggling. The most advanced computer ever created, a computer for a spaceship being woven by hand by women sitting at benches in a factory in Waltham, Massachusetts. So, but that's for me, that was what was fun and completely captivating about the mission, about telling the story, is that you wouldn't believe that if it weren't true. It is kind of an amazing story.
Right. You talked about the little things, the hyphen, the laundry detergent caused an explosion, right?
Well, that too is a kind of incredible story. So everything was tested, and there was a real culture inside Apollo in those days of any failure needed to be investigated. It wasn't like, oh, that's not going to cause a big problem. Anything that went wrong on Earth was considered, not to be cheesy about it, it was considered a gift. Like, okay, it went wrong here where A, it didn't do any damage, and B, we can figure out why it went wrong. Mm-hmm. So during the design and construction of the lunar module had 71, no, the lunar module and the command module together, the whole spacecraft assembly, had 71 high-pressure gas tanks. And a helium tank was being tested out in California at the company that made it, Air Research. And these were sort of sophisticated versions of propane tanks, you know, a top and a bottom welded together, but capable of keeping liquid helium super cool, so hundreds of degrees below zero. And it was pressurized and it exploded. This was 1966. And so, okay, was there something wrong with that tank? Something wrong with the design? Something wrong with the materials that 20 tanks were made out of? We have to do an investigation. And so this was sort of NASA's famous traceability. Everything that went into the spacecraft, and this is still true, this is still the way NASA operates, where did that material come from? Who made it? Where did the raw materials come from? Who excavated those? That whole sort of trail of traceability. And they couldn't quite figure out, they couldn't find anything wrong with the tank, except that there was a crack that caused the explosion where the two hemispheres had been put together. And so the manager of tank construction literally went back and did an investigation. Every single step of the assembly of the tank, he questioned everybody involved, asking, was this tank built in any way differently than a previous tank? And here's what he discovered. A wiping cloth was used to clean the edges of the tanks before they were welded together. And this was the first tank in which the wiping cloths weren't brand new. Somebody had decided that there was no need to use them once and throw them away. We should launder them and reuse them. In a $19 billion project, let's save 14 cents. But that's right, that you can actually appreciate that was, why not? Why throw them away? And it turned out that there were tiny little traces of laundry detergent left in the cloths after they were laundered and rinsed. And that laundry detergent, some of those molecules of laundry detergent, got on the tank when you wiped the edge. And that laundry detergent was corrosive to titanium, which was what the tank was made out of. And so literally individual molecules of laundry detergent corroded the titanium between the two halves of the tank and caused the explosion. Well, imagine the kind of questioning you had to do to get somebody to say, oh yeah, yeah, no, we changed the way we handled the cloth. Like, you wouldn't even think that the wiping cloths were a significant part of the manufacturing process, right? And so, but also, it wasn't trivial. If that tank had exploded during the mission in space, everybody would have died. So it really was an ongoing lesson in appreciating that the smallest things could really change the course and make the difference between success and failure.
Coming up in a moment, we'll hear more about the work of the unseen members of the Apollo program from Charles Fishman. Plus, what he thinks about the state of travel in space today is.
This is, in fact, the most exciting moment, I think, in space since Apollo. What's exciting is what's happening with private companies, what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX, what Jeff Bezos is doing with Blue Origin. Those guys are trying to create the Southwest Airlines of space travel. They are trying to bring the cost of a launch down from $100 million to $1 million. If you want to be on this Thursday's flight, get ready. If you're not ready, there'll be another flight next Thursday. They're trying to create a space economy.
All of that coming up when Talking with Authors continues from HEC Media.
Educate Today offers an ever-growing library of the highest quality video resources, curriculum materials, and interactive programs, all of which are designed to challenge thinking, inspire creativity, and empower learning of students, educators, parents, and lifelong learners. And you can find out more about all these programs by going online to educate.today. That's educate.today.
Of all the stories that you found out through this research, was there one that you really loved or one that you really brought it home for you, how immense this mission was?
Well, you know, the fun of doing this book was that literally every single day there was a discovery. There was a story that they aren't unknown stories, because if they were unknown, I wouldn't have been able to find them.
Right.
But they're stories that are sort of lost to history. And so, you know, I love the fact that when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin got back in the lunar module and took off their helmets, the whole cabin of the lunar module had a smell. It was the smell of moon dirt. And the smell was the smell, they said, of Armstrong described it as the smell of fireplace ashes. And Aldrin said it smelled like the air after a fireworks show, a real sort of smell of burned gunpowder. Well, that's kind of amazing, right? Who knew that the moon had a smell? And then every one of the subsequent five crews that landed on the moon came back in, covered in moon dirt. The moon dirt turned out to be really clingy, hard to remove. They all reported the same thing. Well, that's just a wonderful, you know, that's not, you know, how did we get there? How did we do it? But it's a great moment. You know, we sent a car to the moon. We sent three cars. We sent a car three times to the moon, and it really changed the whole complexion, the whole texture of the moon mission, because walking is hard on the moon, it's exhausting, and NASA had rules. The first three missions didn't have a car. NASA had rules about how far the astronauts could get from the lunar module, not much more than a mile. And if you think about walking a mile isn't that hard, but walking a mile in a spacesuit is actually quite hard. And then you're supposed to do work when you get there, right?
It's not like walking on Earth, because
it's not like walking on Earth. Right. Well, in some ways it's easier, but the astronauts actually found it quite taxing to walk long distances. And part of that was not the gravity, but you're sort of fighting against the spacesuit itself, which is pressurized. So the car really changed the range and ambition of the science you could do. You could pick five things you wanted to visit from Earth and say, we're going to go look at these five really interesting things. And then you could go do it. And you could also stop and say, wait a minute, that looks interesting. Let's take a little side trip and go visit that. And when you arrive, you weren't exhausted,
right?
Because you'd been riding. Well, the only reason we sent a car was because two General Motors engineers insisted that the astronauts would need a car. NASA had actually been developing lunar vehicles to send to the moon on these Apollo flights, but they were imagining, they were literally designing, and they built prototypes of things that were the size of a Honda minivan. And then sort of somebody sort of did the math and said, we're going to need to launch a whole extra rocket just for the rover. And so instead of trying to reimagine that, NASA just canceled the rover development. And these two guys at General Motors, a guy named Sam Romano and a guy named Ferenc Pavlics, they said, the moon car is really important. The astronauts deserve a vehicle, and it's going to be a GM vehicle. And so for 2 years, 2.5 years, they continued to work on developing a car using General Motors money. And then they had built a tiny little prototype about 24 inches long of the vehicle that they had designed that actually worked, was radio controlled. And they took it to Wernher von Braun, who was the sort of legendary rocket pioneer at NASA. They took it to his office and they hid in the corridor and radio control drove the little lunar dune buggy, the lunar Jeep, into his office. And he was on the phone and he was like, whoa, what's this? And he hung up and then he poked his head out, you know, into the corridor, which is just what they expected. And he said, what's going on here? And they came in and said, you know, we work for GM. We've designed this lunar vehicle. It only weighs 460 pounds, right? The spare tire in a Honda Odyssey weighs all 460 pounds. And it folds up like an origami. There's a little compartment in the lunar module. We have designed this vehicle to fit in that compartment. And we really think the astronauts, the last three missions, need a car. That meeting, that little moment when they drove the model car into Wernher von Braun's office, that happened in March 1969. So the first moon mission was just literally weeks away. All the moon equipment was designed and built and tested, and the astronauts had been training on it for months. So the idea that just weeks before the first moon launch, you were going to introduce this whole new, I mean, it's a kind of spaceship, really. Yeah. Was a little crazy, but Wernher von Braun was absolutely captivated with it. He said, you know, you got, this is it. You have figured it out. We don't need something big and elaborate. We need something small that gets the job done. And he is the one who sort of grabbed this idea. He had, you know, he's one of the few people in NASA who really had the oomph at that moment to make it happen. And by the end of 1969, the design team at General Motors had gone from 10 people to 400, and Boeing won the contract to build it. So it was in fact a General Motors car. General Motors designed and engineered. Boeing constructed it, and I'm not sure we would have gone to the moon those last three times if they had just been walking around. People were really like, okay, we're going back again. What are we doing this time? Mm-hmm. You know, and the rover, they literally went 8-10 miles away from the lunar module. They drove around those missions. They did three moonwalks each of which lasted 7 hours. So it was really transformative. So that's a great tale. Who knew that the lunar rover was the result of two guys who just said, I don't care if they've canceled it, this is going to happen.
And that they were able to get their employer to say, okay, invest that money, right?
Yes, that's true, although 10 people at General Motors isn't huge, but you're right. The easy thing inside General Motors would have been to say, why are we building something that they have said they don't want?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then not only did they figure out how to do it, they came up with this clever idea for how to persuade Wernher von Braun how important it was, and then it changed the course of the moon missions. So stories like that, that's why I wanted to write this book, because there's plenty of stories like that about the astronauts, and it's good we know them, and we've heard them 100 times. The 6 successful moon landings involved 18 people. You include Apollo 13, 21 people, 12 of whom actually walked on the moon. 410,000 people back on Earth. So there's a lot of incredible work and imaginative work and great human stories behind what it took to get us there.
So Mike Pence recently said that we're going back to the moon. We're in a space race again with China this time. Do you think that we could have that happen? I think he said in 5 years.
He gave a big speech.
Yeah.
He said the Trump administration wants to go back to the moon in half the time we went the first time.
Right.
I mean, all I'll say is that the NASA budget right now is $20 billion a year. If it were raised to the Apollo level, so that's going to the moon in 10 years, it would be double that. It would be $38 billion a year. And if you want to do it even faster than we did it the first time, you'd probably want to spend more money. And the Trump administration requested a NASA budget this year that was 2% less than last year. So unless there's a magic trick in there somewhere, they are talking about doing something that they're not asking Congress to pay for. This is, in fact, the most exciting moment, I think, in space since Apollo. And what's exciting is not, unfortunately, what NASA's doing. What's exciting is what's happening with private companies, what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX, what Jeff Bezos is doing with Blue Origin. Those guys are trying to create the Southwest Airlines of space travel. They're trying to make it safe, reliable, and inexpensive to go to space. And their goal, they are rivals, and that's good. They like to poke fun at each other,
yeah.
Right? They tweet at each other, but but they're actually doing sort of the same thing, and that's kind of nice. We don't have one airline, we don't have one cell phone company, we don't have one maker of cell phones. They are trying to bring the cost of a launch down from $100 million to $1 million. Now, $1 million is still a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money for a company. $100 million is sort of out of reach unless you're a really big company. $1 million isn't. It's like going from having a modem that you connect your computer to the internet with a phone line versus high-speed internet. High-speed internet is what got us streaming video. It's what got us the whole online commercial world. It's what got us Amazon. Who knows what bringing the price of a space flight down from 100 million to a million is going to get us. But it's going to change the world. Right this minute, here's a perfect example of why this is exciting. Right now, and this has only happened in the last 2 years, every square foot of land on Earth is photographed from space every single day. They don't photograph the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but they photograph the entire landmass of the Earth every day, every part of my front yard, the Washington Monument, the cornfields that are flooded in the Midwest right now. The entire Earth is photographed every single day by a private company called Planet.org. That's how we know what's going on with North Korea, because we photograph their nuclear weapon sites every day. We photograph their ports and their rail yards and their truck yards every day, so you can see what the trains are doing. You can see what's happening at the nuclear weapon sites. This is not the NSA. This is not the CIA. This is not NASA. This is a private company with small satellites launched on private rockets. And it's changing how we understand what other countries are doing. It's also changing how we understand climate and growing food and development patterns in cities. Just that one thing by that one company is an absolute blossoming. When you photograph the same place every single day, day after day after day, for months, you see things that you can't see any other way. That's what's gonna happen once Musk and Bezos really get operational. Right now, in the world, there are about 100 rocket launches in a busy year. Somewhere between 80 and 100 total in the year. Bezos has said he fully expects within a few years that he will be launching once a week. Like, why wouldn't you? On Thursday. It's Thursday. Blue Origin is launching to space, right? If you want to be on this Thursday's flight, get ready. If you're not ready, there'll be another flight next Thursday. That's how trains run, right? That's how trucking companies run. That's how huge cargo ships work, right? Scheduled service. Well, that's what these guys want to do. And I think what that means is that 10 years from now, 15 years from now, you will be able to go do a stint with your company in orbit the way you go to Beijing, the way you go to Delhi. I think you'll be able to go up there the way people go work on an offshore oil rig. It will be something people do, and that's self-sustaining. They're trying to create a space economy. When the Trump administration says, let's go to the moon, let's race, let's spend all this money, you do have to ask the question, to what end? Why? I didn't feel like there was a really good motivation, as there was in the 60s. We were racing the Russians to the moon with good reason, because there was a huge global contest for countries to understand the difference between capitalism and authoritarianism, between democracy and communism. The costs required to go to the moon need to be justified in some way, and at the moment that doesn't feel like it's going to happen. But I think what's going to happen in space in the next 15 years is going to be just as amazing as sort of the blossoming of the online world was 10 and 15 years ago.
Will you be in line to report on it?
I'll be in line to report on it. I'm not sure. I'm getting to the age where I'm not sure I will personally go to space, but I have college age kids, and it's very clear to me that, you know, by the time they're 30, if their work requires it and if they want to, I think we're really going to see a transformation at this moment, as we speak, only about 550 people have been to space total during the entire space age. If you go back to the era of Apollo, we haven't even launched one person a month to space, about 9 a year for the last 50 years. That's not the space age. That's not the Jetsons. That's not the USS Enterprise. But I think 50 years from now, we will look back at this moment, at this anniversary, and say, that was the moment when things started to change again.
Thank you for this conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much. As you can tell, I love telling this story.
That's best-selling journalist and author Charles Fishman talking about his latest book, One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon, from publisher Simon Schuster, during our interview with him in July of 2019.
If you love theater, musicals, and operas, and you'd like to hear reviews of the more than 150 St. Louis area productions that HEC Media covers each year, make sure you subscribe to Two on the Isle, the podcast. Every 2 weeks, you'll get to hear the well-crafted takes on all sorts of stage performances by 25-year-plus reviewers Bob Wilcox and Jerry Kowarski. And you'll get a lesson on how each of the works, old and new, came to be and how they fit in with the stage performances you love. Again, for great theater reviews in St. Louis, subscribe to Two on the Isle, the podcast.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Talking with Authors. Remember, you can watch most of the episodes of this program by going online to hecmedia.org. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. Just search for Talking with Authors on all social media platforms. And if you haven't done so yet, please rate and review this program wherever you get your podcasts. The host of the video version of this program was Angie Weidinger. Supervising producer is Julie Winkle. Photography was by Pete Foggy and Ken Calcaterra. Editor was Carrie Marks. Sound by Paul Langdon, and production support by Jane Ballou and Christina Chastain. HEC Media Executive Director is Dennis Riggs. The Talking with Authors podcast executive producer is Christina Chastain. Podcast producer is Rod Milam. Podcast editors were Paul Langdon and Rod Milam. And I'm your podcast host, Rod Milam. Thank you to NASA for the audio clip of the moon landing on July 20th, 1969. Again, thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This is HEC Media.